is still alive, Rafe will find purpose in bringing her home and helping her recover from whatever she's suffered. Rafe turns to the left. I follow, although I notice that Rafe is farther ahead than he was before. Despite what has happened, the burst of speed makes clear that he's not lost his endurance. At first, that thought encourages me. Then I realize that Rafe is not the one who has changed speed. I have. I've been so concerned with Rafe's state of mind that I've not noticed the weight that seems to press on me with every turn of the pedals. At the end of the journey to Rafe's house was death. There had always been a possibility that I would come to Rafe's aid if he needed me, but it wasn't necessary. This journey is different. While blood stains my hands, I've never before set out to commit murder. Tonight I'm doing exactly that. Rafe stops so suddenly I have to turn my handlebars to avoid crashing into him. "Look," he says. I squint into the darkness, trying to see what he sees. Skimmers. At the other end of the block, traveling toward us without their running lights engaged. The lack of lights is both illegal and dangerous. Neither problem is likely of much concern to those who pilot the vehicles. "This way," Rafe whispers, and he leads me off the paved roadway and onto the grass. I cast glances behind me, trying to see if the skimmer pilots have noticed us, but the black of the night makes it hard to tell. Rafe must think there's a chance we've been detected because he doesn't slow as we ride in between two tall trees 100 feet from the road. Riding on the rougher terrain has slowed his pace enough for me to keep up. "This way." Rafe darts behind the house to our right and stops. Putting a finger to his lips, he glances around the corner at the street to see if we're being pursued. I hold my breath. A minute passes. Two. Then I hear the hum of engines moving closer. But from the sound, I can't tell if they're leaving the street or traveling along it. Finally, I see a shadow darker than the rest, slowly moving along the road toward the east. It's small, the same size as the skimmers we used during our induction, although I'm certain this one is faster and in better repair. A second skimmer appears. Rafe points out a third. The seeming lack of urgency suggests they are performing a basic patrol. Three patrols in one location seems excessive on a normal day, but I'm not surprised to see them congregated here since we're near so many of the dwellings where top officials reside. We were lucky not to have run into more trouble on Rafe's block. Or were we? I see the skimmers stop and watch as one by one they turn around and head back in the direction from which they came. If they were on basic patrol, they would keep going to secure the rest of the neighborhood. These safety officials are guarding something. Since Dr. Barnes's house is only 100 yards away, I can guess what that something is. The lead skimmer passes our position as I hear the click. And another. It's coming from the transit communicator in my bag. "Zine." Rafe turns his head. A second skimmer comes into view. The click sounds 3 more times. When I don't pick up, a voice calls. "Sia, answer me." Zine's frantic plea echoes in the quiet of the night. I reach into my bag to find the communicator and shut it down. My fingers fumble with the fastener as Zine yells, "I'm coming, but Simon is..." I hit the off switch. Everything goes silent. No, not everything. The hum of the skimmer engine turns to a roar. The running lights flare to life as the skimmer turns and heads across the grass. Directly at us. Chapter 17. Terror fuels my feet. "Follow me," I whisper as loud as I dare, hoping my words can be heard over the roar of the skimmers' engines as they throttle up. These skimmers are bound to be fast and easy to maneuver. That's almost enough to make me think our fate is sealed. Our only chance is to ride around the far side of the house and double back toward the road before they see us. If they can't see us, they won't know which direction to follow. I take a standing position to gain more momentum. The sound of Rafe's harsh, fast breathing tells me he's not far behind. We're almost to the edge of the house when my front wheel hits something. I jolt as the bike slows to a crawl. Panic flares as Rafe zips past and around the corner. I try to push the pedals again, but they won't turn. Whatever I hit must be wedged in the gears. Jumping off my bike, I lift it by the frame and run. Between the bulk of the bag and the weight of the bike, my movements are awkward. Engines roar somewhere behind me. I don't think they're close, yet, but I can't tell for sure, and I don't dare take the time to look. My feet stumble. Rafe takes the bike from me and runs to a small group of bushes. He slides the bike under it and then grabs my hand and dashes toward the front of the house.
Dr. Barnes lives two houses down on the north side of the street. I'll meet you there in 10 minutes.
I don't have a chance to argue as he darts away. Without thinking, I run to the front of the next house and cross the street. The slap of my boots on the pavement makes me cringe. When I reach the grass on the other side, I brave a look behind me. The skimmers have not yet reached the end of the house we came around. My heart pounds. I run as fast as I'm able and drop to the ground near the wall of the house and flatten myself against the dirt. I keep my face lowered, hoping my dark hair will blend into the shadows. The sound of an engine comes closer. Slowly, I move my right hand. My fingers search for the side pocket of my bag and the gun I have stored there. I can feel the seam of the pocket, but I can't slip my hand inside without shifting my entire body, giving myself away. I hear the sound of the other skimmer. I press my cheek to the ground and squeeze my eyes shut as I wait for shouts, increased engine power, or anything that would indicate I have been spotted. My whole body quivers with the urge to run, but I force myself to stay put. The smell of rich dirt evokes memories of my father. My first memories are of the smell of earth that surrounded him when he'd come home after a day of working in his greenhouse. It's a smell I've always associated with hope. I cling to that as I wait. 3 gunshots slash through the night. Somewhere to the left. Perhaps a few houses away, maybe more. Did a safety official find Rafe? Has he survived? I want to look for him, but getting myself captured or killed will not help anyone. Instead, I bite my lip, force back tears of frustration, and hold my position. The engine closest to me roars and disappears in the direction of the gunshots. I force myself to count back from 50 in case another patrol comes by. 50, 49, 48, 47. The seconds feel like hours. When I reach 5, I lay my hands flat on the ground. 2, 1. Pushing to my knees, I blink at the darkness. There are no signs of the skimmers or their running lights. Can I still hear their engines? No. My legs tremble as I climb to my feet. The pain that streaks up my leg makes my knees buckle. When I reach down to adjust the bandage, it's wet. My leg is bleeding. I consider my options. Go to the north and around the back of this structure toward Dr. Barnes' house, or see if Rafe needs my help. There is really only one choice. Rafe could be captured or dead. All I can do is continue to follow our original plan and hope for the best. Slowly, I cross the grass to the back of the house. The breeze rustles the leaves on nearby trees. Somewhere in the distance, I hear a dog bark. No engines, no sound of footsteps other than mine. I pass several windows as I walk, but see no faces peering out.
When I reach the end of the structure, I glance around the corner toward the street. Nothing. I quickly cross the expanse of lawn between this house and the next, the one that Rafe told me belongs to Dr. Jedediah Barnes. The house is 2 stories tall. A flicker of light from a second-story window tells me someone is home. As I walk to the back door, I glance through the rear first-story windows, but it's too dark to see within. The door is unlocked. I tighten the hold on my gun and start to push it open.
See ya.
I turn the barrel toward the sound of my name and squint into the darkness for the source. When I can't make out the person running toward me, I raise my flashlight and hit the switch. After the events in the stadium, I think the risk of exposing my position is worth it. When the beam illuminates Rafe's face, I let out a sigh of relief and switch off the light.
Are you okay? I ask when he reaches my side. I heard gunshots and thought you'd been killed.
I used to play with some of the kids in this neighborhood, he whispers near my ear. There are old water ducts at the end of the block. They're not easy to find if you don't know where to look. I fired a couple of shots to draw the safety officials in my direction, and then went into one of the ducts and crawled until I came out on the other side of the block, which is harder to do now than when I was smaller. Are you ready?
Am I? Could I ever be ready for what I now must do? I'm ready for this to be over, I answer.
Then let's go.
Rafe pushes the door open and steps cautiously into darkness. I follow, closing the door behind me, then turn on my flashlight. We're in a large kitchen. My light shows dark wood cabinets, white and gray countertops, and a large wooden table. There are no dishes in sight, no glasses in the sink. My mother would approve. Rafe frowns.
What's wrong? I whisper. Probably nothing, he says. When my father and I came to visit, Mrs. Barnes let me hang out in here. She always had flowers on the table and things her kids made on the countertop by the sink.
I shine my light again. The countertops and table are clear of decorations. Out of curiosity, I open one of the cabinet doors. In it are 2 plates, 2 bowls. The next one contains 3 mugs and 2 drinking glasses. I think of what my mother keeps in our kitchen. Because my father's job requires him to be close to the area he's currently working to revitalize, we move often. So Mom tries to keep our possessions to a minimum for ease of relocation. Despite that, we have at least 6 or 7 pots and pans, over 12 plates, and a large number of cups. I have a hard time believing that what's contained in these cupboards is enough to service a family of 5.
Let's go.
Rafe turns toward the door that leads to the rest of the house. I keep the light pointed in front of us as we walk through a hallway that takes us to a large room. On one side is a wide staircase. A sofa, small table, and 2 blue chairs are arranged in the middle of the room. A shelf on the wall contains a number of books, but, as in the kitchen, there are no personal objects of any kind in the room. No paintings or baskets filled with knitting needles like I noticed in Rafe's house. The furniture and rug look comfortably worn, but still the house feels as though it's not really lived in. Gun in hand, Rafe leads the way up the stairs. As I follow, I run my finger along the wood banister. It comes away clean. No dust. Despite the meager furnishings, someone still lives here. We reach the top of the stairs and turn to the left. The light I saw from outside is coming from an open door 15 feet away. The rest of the doors in the hall are closed. No lights shine from beneath them. Rafe glances at me and nods. I turn off my flashlight, put it in my pocket, and nod back. This is it. It's easy to keep our approach quiet. The carpet on this floor is thick. When we're steps away from the door, Rafe looks at me and mouths the word,
go.
He races through the door. I step in after him with my finger poised on the trigger, prepared to fire. Only no one is there. The chair behind a large desk stacked with papers is empty. The shelves in this room are stuffed with books worn from use. A large rocking chair sits near a window. Beside it is a small table stacked high with paper-filled folders. Without discussion, Rafe and I walk out of the room and search the rest of the upstairs rooms. No one occupies them. But we do find answers of another sort. In the largest bedroom, we see a portrait of Dr. Barnes, his wife, and their children on the nightstand. But when we look in the closets, we find clothes that belong only to him. There are no toys or clothes in the other bedrooms. Dr. Barnes still lives here, but his family doesn't. Why? We go back to the office to see if answers can be found there. Rafe stands at the desk. I walk to the rocking chair and sit on the floor next to a pile of papers. But before I can open the first file, I remember Zine. Opening my bag, I take out the transit communicator, turn it back on, and click the call button. When Zine doesn't answer, I click the button 3 more times, hoping he'll understand that I'm now able to talk. That I have not heard the message that he took such a chance to relay to me. The communicator stays silent. Whatever Zine is doing at this moment, he can't hear me, or can't get to his communicator. Biting my lip, I set the device to the side and search for the pulse radio. The message light is on, so I press play and feel a tear slide down my cheek as Tomas's voice fills the room.
"The first step is complete. We're moving on to the second."
His voice is strained. He promises to contact me once their next task is finished, and then says,
"I hope you are safe. Remember, I love you."
Warmth floods my body as I cling to one thought. Tomas is alive.
"He didn't say what happened with Professor Chen," Rafe says.
"No." I noticed that omission too. Perhaps Tomas is being careful, but his tone tells me something went wrong. Since there is nothing we can do about what has happened, I say, "They must have found her, or he would have said they were unable to complete the first step. They might be with Professor Holt now. We have to decide what to do next. Where do you think Dr. Barnes and his family could be?"
"Dr. Barnes must have decided to move his family somewhere safe in case something went wrong with his plan, but I can't imagine he'd leave Tosu City."
I agree. Simon is in charge of directing the rebellion, but Dr. Barnes gives orders to Simon. He wouldn't leave, not when the events he has orchestrated are about to be put in motion. According to the president's information, he spends a lot of time at the testing center. I think our best chance of finding him would be there.
"Getting off campus was hard," Rafe frowns. "I'm guessing security is even tighter now."
"If we have to get past the safety officials, we will," I say with more confidence than I feel. "But it would be better if we knew for certain if Dr. Barnes is there." I glance at the papers in piles around the room. Maybe there's something here that will help. We might even be able to find evidence of what happened to your sister and the other students. That kind of proof to supplement the death of some of the top testing advocates might aid us in ending the testing, even if Dr. Barnes has gone into hiding. But we can't stay here for long. My gut tells me Dr. Barnes is still in the area. If we're going to find him, we need to continue our hunt.
"Let's do a quick search," I say, opening the first folder in the stack next to me. "If we don't find anything after 10 minutes, we should get going."
As Rafe flips through papers on the desk, I focus on the pages in my hand. At the top of the first page is a name, Ayana Kirk. Beneath it are listed grades for 12 years of studies, as well as notes that say the student especially excelled in physics and music.
There are several recommendation letters from teachers. In a different hand, I see notes in the margin questioning whether the student's musical proclivities make her too sensitive to withstand further education, or whether she might be better served by a mid-level education job instead of reaching for a higher position. These questions must have been sent to those who wrote the recommendations because more letters follow, addressing the concerns as well as a note that an invitation to take the university exam was sent. I flip the page, and my heart sinks as I see the words, redirected and assigned to resource program under Professor Cartwright. Beneath that is Dr. Barnes's signature and a date. This student failed her examination last year. The signature is in the same hand as the notations in the margins throughout the file. I skim through the next file. Another failed student, another redirection. This one also from last year. As I quickly scan the pages, I notice that all the files stacked here are from the past 10 years. No students previous to that time are included. All were redirected. The older the application file is, the fewer notations in the margins. Not a single question is written for those who applied a decade past. As I do the math, I notice something else. Unless files are missing, over 3 times as many students were redirected 10 years ago than last year.
"What did you find?" Rafe asks.
"I'm not sure," I say. Or maybe I am, and I don't want to admit that what I'm seeing is real. Dr. Barnes is the force behind the testing. He's the one who created tests that kill and who turned failed university applicants into resources to be experimented on. And yet, if these files are authentic, he's been working to convince applicants he believes are doomed to fail to choose another path before they make a choice they can't take back, just as he did with Rafe's sister. Why?
Maybe officials who traveled to the colonies began to notice that none of the redirected students were ever seen there,
Rafe suggests when I explain what I've found.
Limiting the number of unsuccessful applicants means fewer questions he'll have to answer for officials and families here in Tosu.
That makes sense, especially since President Colander took office just 6 years ago. I glance at the clock on my watch. Our 10 minutes are up. We need to get moving.
Did you find anything? I ask. A couple of reports suggesting the testing be limited to 100 candidates. During the past several years, a larger percentage than is acceptable to Dr. Barnes has been eliminated during the first examination. Nothing that helps figure out where Dr. Barnes is now.
Rafe frowns.
Although, there's also a calendar that shows the scheduled meetings for this year's selection of testing candidates, along with the preliminary names.
Rafe holds out the papers and I cross the room and take them. The first page is a list of potential candidates. My soul aches as I read name after name, along with the colonies they belong to. Finally, I come to Five Lakes Colony and the names Daylene Dasho, Leanne Maddows, and Christoph Nussmann. All students I know. I've played sports with them and studied beside them. All three will celebrate their selection for the testing, not knowing that the price of failure is more than they should ever be forced to pay. Pushing aside the emotions that threaten to overwhelm me, I flip to the calendar. There was a meeting of the committee earlier today at the testing center. I doubt Dr. Barnes would have missed it. The meeting must have ended hours ago. Dr. Barnes could have left after it was over, but this is the only clue we have as to his whereabouts. We have no choice but to follow it. When I tell Rafe we're headed to campus, he says,
"Before we leave, there's something you need to see. There's a file here with your name on it."
He places the file in my hand and watches as I open it. The paper is the same gray color as the one given to me by Professor Colander. Only this time, instead of finding Dr. Barnes's name and information inside, I find my own. Melencia Vale. Age at testing, 16. Colony, Five Lakes. Group, wide range of aptitude. Defining attribute, mechanical ability. First round testing, pass. Notes, strong emotional reaction to candidate self-termination. We'll watch to see if this affects future testing. Second round testing, pass. Notes, again, strong emotional reaction to candidate failure, yet still completed this test. Third round testing, pass. Notes, unusual need to aid teammates when allowing those teammates to fail would bring candidate closer to achieving her goal. Her personal beliefs are in conflict with the committee's criteria for passage to the university. However, strong demonstration of candidate's ability to trust her instincts and persuade others makes her unique. I believe she is my best chance and have taken steps to go around my colleagues in an effort to aid and test her further in round four. Best chance? I read the line again. Best chance of what? Was Dr. Barnes the reason Simon gave me food, water, and the vial that helped me in my interview? From what I see here, it appears he must be. But why? I don't understand. Fourth round of testing. Failure recommended by staff. Candidate is not questioning enough of others and not committed enough to her agenda to do whatever is necessary for the country's future development. Does not have a strong enough personality to make difficult choices. Failure. I shake my head and read the words again. Not a strong enough personality. If the committee sought to eliminate me as a candidate, why was I accepted? Interview. Candidate surprised committee with emotional restraint and strongly worded responses. Some have been swayed to allow her passage. Most have not. Committee recommendation, failure. Final result, pass. Despite everything I did, the committee believed I had failed. Those words on the page make my knees go weak. It shouldn't matter what the testing officials believed. But seeing proof that I was not good enough or strong enough to them is like a slap in the face. My best wasn't worthy of their acceptance. None of this makes sense, I say, looking up from the folder. Why did I pass the testing if the committee recommended I fail? Rafe shakes his head. It looks like Dr. Barnes intervened. Maybe that's the reason Professor Holt has been upset about your presence at the university from the first day you arrived in her residence. She would have known you had been marked for failure and yet somehow survived. What do you think it means? I don't know. And there's only one way to find out. I pick up my bag and shove the folder inside. We have to find Dr. Barnes. Let's go. Rafe glances around the room. I don't know if it's important, but it just occurred to me what's been bothering me since we got here. The lamp in this room was on. Dr. Barnes would never have left a light on all day by mistake. Why? I don't ask the rest of the question because I guess the answer. Dr. Barnes left the light on because he wants people to think he's here. The safety patrols that roam this street, even though all other officials are looking on the other side of the city for whoever set the explosives. This is a trap. Chapter 18. Rafe and I look around the room for a sign that I'm right and find it beneath the desk. A black box with wires and a blinking light. An explosive. Is it on a timer or is it waiting to be tripped by something else? It's impossible to say. Only one thing is clear. We have to get out of here. Rafe must agree because he grabs his things and is right behind me as I hurry into the hall. We're halfway down the stairs when a door somewhere below us closes. I turn off my flashlight and consider our options. Going upstairs will get us out of sight, but this is the only staircase down. If we hide in one of the second-story rooms, we risk being stuck in our hiding place. So I hurry down the stairs as quickly as I can. The front door is only about 20 steps to the right, but when I calculate the time it will take to get there, unlock the door, and get out, I discard that option, especially since I hear the sound of footsteps from somewhere in the back of the house. Grabbing Rafe's hand, I race down the last 6 stairs, race to my left, and duck behind the sofa. Rafe joins me just as the lights in this area flare to life.
"You two stay here," a familiar voice says quietly. "Simon, if he's here, what happened to Zine?"
Rafe stiffens beside me. He too has recognized the voice. The carpet dulls the sound of footsteps as Simon climbs the stairs. But what I do hear makes me think more than one person made the ascent. A few minutes later, Simon calls down, "He's not here yet. We'll wait. Turn off the lights. One of you go to each end of the block and hold that position. The minute you see him, signal me." The lights blink out. Footsteps disappear down the hallway toward the back of the house. A door slams upstairs. The minute Rafe hears that, he peers around the side of the sofa. He waits for a moment and then whispers, "Stay there," as he slips out from behind the couch. Several seconds later, he returns, taps me on the shoulder, and motions for me to follow him. Slowly, we cross the dark room, careful to steer clear of the furnishings and avoid making noise. I want to go up the stairs, demand to know where my brother is, and put a bullet in Simon's head. But if Simon sets off Dr. Barnes's trap, I don't want to be caught in it, too. I brush my fingers along the wall to guide me and am relieved when the hall opens into the kitchen. When I head for the door, Rafe grabs my hand and whispers, "We have to split up. If you move fast, the two people he sent to guard the ends of the street won't yet be in position. You'll get out of the area without being seen and be able to get back to campus. Go to the testing center. I'll deal with Simon. You have to find Dr. Barnes."
"You saw what's in his office. You can't go up there."
"Simon's working with him. He has to know about the bomb. There's no choice. We have to eliminate him."
"Then I'll stay." If Simon knows anything about Zine, I might be able to find that out before I pull the trigger. Rafe shakes his head.
"The minute a gun is fired, the guards will come running. Knowing this neighborhood is the only thing that's going to help me get away."
He walks me toward the door and takes my hand.
"This is our only shot at getting them both. You know I'm right."
I don't want to agree, but I do. Rafe has a better chance alone. I have to trust him to do this, just as he is trusting me.
"I'll see you soon," I whisper.
Rafe leans forward. His lips press against my cheek. His fingers tighten around mine as he whispers,
"You will. Be careful when you get to campus. The rebel students could cause you more problems than the safety officials. And just in case something goes wrong here, I need you to do something for me. Find my sister and tell her I'm sorry. I never thought I'd trust someone the way I trusted Emily, let alone someone from the colonies. But I believe in you. You'll do what's right."
Then he's gone. He slips into the shadows of the hallway, out of sight. Outside, the breeze is cool on my face. I close the door quietly behind me and slowly look from side to side. When I see and hear nothing, I consider which way to go. Since the guards are posted to the west and east, I run north and realize why Simon didn't worry about someone approaching from this direction. 50 yards from the house is a large wall that stands at least 8 feet high and spans the length of this block. The barrier is made of smooth stone. There's nowhere to get a good handhold, and I can't reach the top without a boost. Squinting into the darkness, I spot a tree about 20 feet away and head for it.
The willow tops the wall by 5 or 6 feet. The tree is fairly young, probably about 4 years old. I pull on one of the lower hanging branches. It's thin, supple. Not ideal for climbing, but this is the only one I see that is close set enough to the stone wall to be of help. Still, the tree stands about 8 feet away, which means I will have to climb as high as possible for this to work. I shift my bag so it doesn't get caught on the branches, put one foot on the trunk, and pull myself up. The lowest hanging limb bends under my weight but doesn't break. I reach as close to the top as I dare, position my feet on two V's near the trunk where the branches are sturdiest, and take a deep breath. The sound of gunshots makes me flinch. Rafe. I force myself not to look behind me. Instead, I grab the thin center of the tree as the branch under my left foot breaks and smashes to the ground. I hear shouts, more shots. The limbs sag as I quickly step from one fork to another. At the third fork, I push off hard and extend my arms as I jump toward the wall. My chest makes contact with the top of the stone barrier. I bite my lip to prevent myself from crying out as I start to slide down. The stone grates against my fingers, but I refuse to let go. My arms tremble. Sweat breaks out on the back of my neck. I almost lose my grip as an explosion roars behind me. I finally find a good holding spot with my boots and use my leg muscles to propel me up and over. Before I drop to the other side, I catch a glimpse of smoke and licks of fire coming from Dr. Barnes's house. I allow myself 5 seconds of hope as I scan the area for Rafe before I let go of my grip, drop to the other side, and run. I race across the grass, run between two houses, and reach the street on the other side. Beams from flashlights cut through the darkness as people awakened by the sounds come out of their homes. Everyone looks scared. I'm certain I do. Between the spectacle of the fire and the fear, no one gives me a second look as I walk quickly down the street. Away from the flames. Away from Rafe. If he survived the explosion, he might at this very moment need my help. But I don't turn, because he would never forgive me for risking our mission. As I walk, I can only wonder who will be next, and if anything we do is worth the price paid. When I can no longer hear the shout of voices, I duck under a bush and pull out the transit communicator. I select the coordinates for the government studies residence that I saved in the device during induction. I'm a half mile from campus. If I start walking now, I should be there in less than 10 minutes. I look at the moon and try to judge the time that has passed since Tomas, Stacia, Rafe, and I left the house. 2 hours? 3? It seems impossible that so much has happened in so little time. Rafe is probably dead. Zine still does not answer my calls. Tomas and Stacia were okay when Tomas left his message, but who knows where they are now? I push to my feet. My legs tremble as I shift my bag back onto my shoulder and start walking. Slowly at first, then faster until I'm running as fast as I can. The sooner I find Dr. Barnes, the sooner everything will be over. The testing, the experiments on Rafe's sister and the other failed students, the deaths I've been asked to execute, all of it, it has to end. My lungs burn, my pulse pounds, both make me feel alive. It isn't until I see familiar landmarks that tell me I'm only a block from the university gates that I slow. I click the call button on the communicator one last time, not caring if Zine speaks and someone else overhears. I need to hear his voice. But the device stays silent. I feel a part of my heart go still as I slide it back into my bag and exchange it for the pulse radio. The indicator light is dark. Recording a whispered message, I tell Tomas, Stacia, and Will that I'm currently headed to where we began this journey. Then I press send. Instead of putting the radio back in my bag, I slide it into my jacket pocket to keep the thought of Tomas close, and I start moving through the shadows. The archway of the university entrance comes into view. Seeing it again, I remember how I felt the first time I rode beneath it. Tomas, Malachi, and Zandri were beside me as we spotted the wrought iron sign that reads, "The University of the United Commonwealth." Despite my father's warnings, I felt excitement and hope. I don't cross under the archway now. If anyone suspects I'm on my way here, this is where they will wait. Instead, I head toward the TU administration building on the edge of campus. I'm careful to keep my tread light so no one nearby hears me as I walk through the darkness, listening for sounds of officials or rebels lurking nearby, and thinking of the day I left Five Lakes Colony, before the testing, when I trusted others, but was not always sure I trusted myself. Heading toward where this all started, I think I finally understand why the testing was created. In a time when each decision could mean the difference between a country rebuilt and one that becomes too broken to repair, the founders of the testing were not willing to trust anyone's best intentions. They needed leaders who were not just smart or kind or nice, but who were capable of making the tough choices that most people would not want to make, of putting necessity above all else and acting on it without hesitation. Stacia is right. President Dalton faltered. His wasn't the worst mistake, but historians say that by the fourth stage of war, it was clear that peace talks had no chance of prevailing. Despite so many deaths and so much destruction, the leaders of the main alliances still believed their desire for conquest could be fulfilled. They had invested too much to step back. Doing so would have been akin to admitting they were wrong. The only measure that could have stopped the fourth stage from progressing would have been to eliminate the leaders who were marching the world toward destruction. Had that happened, perhaps those who took their place could have seen the futility of the devastation around them and taken steps to end the war. But that didn't happen. The leaders pushed forward with their war, and the world collapsed. The United Commonwealth rose from the ashes of that world, and the testing was created to ensure that leaders would not fail like that again. But while the testing seeks to push candidates to show what they are capable of, it fails to recognize that different circumstances bring about different results. The testing committee believed I should be cast as one who failed because I couldn't do what was necessary. How I passed is still a mystery, but the journey I make now shows how wrong they were. The sound of boots slapping against pavement hits me, and I slip behind a bush. The footsteps are somewhere to my left. I squint into the darkness and spot two people racing south. Officials? Rebels? There's no way to know. When they disappear, I wait for several minutes before walking in the opposite direction. I see the edge of the fence in the distance and hurry to reach it. When I do, I'm glad for the lack of windows in the back of the TU administration building, and I slip around the fence onto campus. Gunshots sound in the distance. A siren starts to wail as more gunfire erupts. I flatten myself behind a bush and wait. A scream rises above the din. Other voices shout and more shots are fired. All of it sounds as if it's taking place on the other side of campus. When another round of gunfire rings out from somewhere far to my left, I clasp the gun and stand. Careful to keep to the shadows, I cross behind the building and head toward the stadium, trying not to think of what happened there only yesterday. But I do think of Tomas. Is he safe? The radio light stays dark. Just past the stadium, I see it. Five stories tall and almost hidden in the darkness because of its black steel and black glass exterior. The fence that surrounds the area around it also blends into the night, but I know it's there, along with the small bronze sign that announces the purpose of the work that takes place inside. The testing center. The last time I was inside that building, Dr. Barnes announced that the 20 of us seated in the room with him had been accepted to the university. Tomas and I were together. Without my memories of the testing I had just passed through, I was happy. I spot a figure standing in the shadows near the front of the building and go still. Without getting closer, I can't determine whether the man is one of the rebel students or a safety official. But all the activity to the south has not pulled his attention, so I know he'll not be drawn away easily. I will have to find a way around him or another way inside. A back door or windows on the main floor would allow me to enter without being seen. I don't recall the presence of either, but I circle around to the back of the building to check. The black fence that surrounds the building grounds is only chest high and easy to scale. Once on the other side, I confirm what I hope was not true. The guarded entrance is the only way inside. As silently as possible, I cross the area behind the testing center. The upper story windows are darkened, making it impossible to know if Dr. Barnes is inside. Have I ever seen light coming from the windows here? I don't think so. The only time I remember being outside this building during the testing was in the daytime, when we were waiting for the results of the first test and they allowed us to go outside. Xandri, Malachi, Tomas, and I sat near a small pond. As I approach that spot now, I remember how Xandri's hair caught the sunlight and the way she made Malachi laugh. Last year, the fountain in the middle of the pond was broken. To pass the time, Tomas and I worked together to repair it. The fountain is currently turned off, and I wonder if there's a way to use it to create a diversion. The gunfire has stopped, but the siren still sounds as I find the power box nestled discreetly in a pile of rocks. As I did months ago, I remove the cover with the screwdriver attachment of my pocket knife, and this time use my flashlight to view the contents. Everything looks as it did when Tomas and I fixed the fountain last summer, and I think I should be able to make the motor whine and grind enough to attract the guard's notice. It takes several tries to make the adjustments to the motor, wrap long pieces of grass around the impeller blade, and block the water return pump in a way that will cause the now hindered motor to be even more overworked. The combination should tax the machinery to produce rumbling and a high-pitched whine. Or the motor might overheat and stop working altogether. There's only one way to find out which. After taking a deep breath, I get ready to run and hit the power switch. The water gurgles in the fountain as I dash toward the building. The sound of the grinding motor begins as I edge my way along the back of the building toward the north side. The motor lets out a screech loud enough to be heard over the siren. It only lasts for a few seconds before the damage I did causes the motor to give out with a loud bang. Was the noise enough? Yes. I hear footsteps and duck around the corner of the building as whoever was in the front now looks for the source of the sound. Hoping to get inside before he returns, I race to the entrance. But I start to panic as I see the small keypad next to the door. I remember Michael using a code with 6 numbers to gain us entry, but I didn't see what they were. Even if I had, I doubt they have remained the same. I turn away from the pad and focus my attention on the lock above the door handle, hoping I can jimmy it before the guard returns. The sound of running feet and the voice yelling for me to stop tell me I'm too late. I do the only thing I can. I turn, aim at the safety official as he raises his weapon, and fire. I meant to hit the man's leg. Instead, my bullet punches into his stomach. His weapon goes off as he hits the ground, and I press against the door behind me and feel it give way. The lock wasn't engaged. The man behind me groans in pain. I want to help him, but I tamp down that instinct and step through the doorway. Between the unlocked door and the man I shot lying on the ground outside, someone will soon discover I'm here. I have to find Dr. Barnes. Fast. Clicking my flashlight, I shine it around the building's entrance. Everything in the lobby is as I remember it. White walls, scuffed gray floor, gray wooden chairs in the corner. The testing storage room and personal preparation rooms are on this floor. I won't find Dr. Barnes in those. If he's in this building, he will be on one of the upper floors. I run down the long white and gray hallway to the bank of elevators we rode during the testing to reach the upper four floors. But I don't want to be trapped inside an elevator if someone discovers that I'm here. So I walk past them down the hall, looking for stairs. I find them at the end of the corridor and begin to climb. The building is large. The task of finding someone in this place is daunting. When I reach the second floor, I step out into the hallway and shine my light down the corridor. I could search floor by floor, and I will if I have to, but for now I follow my instincts, turn back to the stairs, and climb to the third floor. It was on this floor that Dr. Barnes spoke to us about each phase of the testing and gave us each set of instructions. This level was also the location of our interviews. It was during mine that I learned Tomas was responsible for Xandri's death, although Dr. Barnes refused to tell me how. When I step out of the stairwell into a dimly lit hallway, I'm certain that Dr. Barnes is near. Sliding the flashlight into my bag, I pull out my gun and walk toward the lecture hall. Blood pounds in my ears as I approach the large double doors that lead to the room where I began and ended my testing. When I take hold of one of the door handles, I feel the same anxiety and fear I did when I entered this room for the first time months ago. Inside, the stage is dark. In the shadows, I see the same podium Dr. Barnes spoke behind, standing at the center. The tiered seats are empty, but if I close my eyes, I can see the faces of those who died. If Dr. Barnes has his way, this room will soon be filled with more candidates ready to be tested. Knowing that steadies the gun in my hand as I turn and walk to the very end of the lecture hall toward the room where I was interviewed. I see a thin slice of light under the door. I put my hand on the knob. In my mind, I list the names of the candidates who walked through the doors of this building. Those names give me courage as I slowly turn the knob, push open the door, and step inside. Seated at a black table near the back windowless wall with a pen in his hand is Dr. Barnes. I wrap both hands around the butt of the gun, plant my feet firmly on the floor, and prepare to fire as Dr. Barnes looks up from the table and smiles. "Good evening, Sia," he says. "We've been expecting you." Before I can wonder who we is, I hear a click and feel the cold metal of a gun barrel as it's pressed against my head. And I know I have failed. Chapter 19. A hand reaches out and wrests the gun from my hand. Another person grabs the bag off my shoulder and laughs. I know that laughing. Turning, I see a sneer spread across Griffin's face as he drops my bag to the ground. "You might want to be careful with that." Dr. Barnes rises from behind the table and crosses toward me. "Ms. Vale may have one or two more tricks up her sleeve." He reaches out and takes my gun from a third-year government studies student I've never spoken to. "Thank you for your assistance. Now, if you don't mind waiting outside, Ms. Vale and I have matters to discuss. You'll both be rewarded once our conversation is complete." Annoyance flickers across Griffin's face as he stalks toward the door. The other boy follows. When the door clicks shut, Dr. Barnes picks my bag off the floor, walks back to his chair, and places the bag on the table.
Please, have a seat. I know you haven't gotten a lot of rest in recent weeks.
You've been quite busy, Sia.
So busy, in fact, I was concerned something might happen to you before you had a chance to meet me tonight. That would have been a shame, since there's much to discuss.
He motions for me to sit in the black chair that is situated across from him at the table. The smile Dr. Barnes wears is familiar. It's filled with warmth and concern, and is designed to elicit trust. His expression turns puzzled when I don't take a seat.
You did come here to talk to me, didn't you, Sia?
I came here to kill you.
Of course you did.
His smile widens as he sets my gun down on the table in front of him.
And I intend to let you, of course, he adds. You will still have to deal with the individuals outside if you succeed. I apologize for that, but I couldn't take the chance of you killing me before we had this conversation.
You're going to let me kill you? Confusion, nerves, and fear make me laugh, although nothing has ever seemed less funny. Dr. Barnes leans back in his chair.
You don't believe me, Sia?
No.
Now he laughs. I suppose I don't blame you, although do you really think you'd be standing here right now if I didn't intend for you to complete your agenda? You've come a long way since first stepping into this building, but there's still much for you to learn.
I think of the lock that was disengaged downstairs, the lack of dishes and clothes at Dr. Barnes's house, the papers and files in plain sight in his study, the explosion that burned his house, and the ease with which I crossed campus despite all the fighting going on. Even the guard outside who had the chance to fire at me before I shot him. While the plan that I embarked on was well thought out, I could not have made it this far without some kind of help. Help Dr. Barnes is now claiming he provided? Why?
You're right, I say, shifting my gaze to the gun.
While this room is small, the gun is too far away to reach before Dr. Barnes does. I'm not sure if Dr. Barnes's nod of approval is for my decision not to take that risk, or for my understanding of the help I've received. It doesn't matter because he's correct. We have to talk. I need answers that only he can provide. Once I have those, I'll find a way to get the gun, because I don't believe for a moment that Dr. Barnes intends to die. Crossing to the black, high-backed chair, I take a seat.
I do have more to learn, Dr. Barnes, but somehow I doubt you and Professor Holt will allow me to return to class after everything that has happened.
Professor Holt would certainly stand in your way. She's been suspicious of your abilities since you first arrived for the testing. She was especially unhappy when you were passed through to the university, despite her objections. She never understood how you received enough votes.
He gives me a pleased smile. However, due to tonight's activities, Verna is no longer a consideration. Neither is Mei-Lin Chen. So they won't be around to complain if you decide to continue your education. Then again, after everything you've been through, you may wish to leave Tosu City and return to Five Lakes. If so, I'm certain your family will be happy to see you.
Hearing Dr. Barnes mention my family makes it hard to breathe, but I keep my emotions off my face. I will not give him the satisfaction of knowing that his verbal jab connected. Keeping my tone flat, I say, "You went to a lot of trouble to arrange this meeting. I doubt it was because you want to talk to me about whether or not I'd like to go back to my colony."
"You don't believe I'd allow you to return home?"
He leans forward and rests his hands next to the gun.
"No."
I can't take my eyes away from his fingers as they brush the butt. "I don't believe you."
"I have no reason to lie," he says, wrapping his hand around the wooden handle.
Of course, I don't expect you to take my word on that. Gun in hand, he rises and crosses the room to a small bench I failed to notice before. On the bench is a tray. Atop that tray is a glass filled with clear liquid. Dr. Barnes takes the glass with his free hand, walks over to the table, and places the glass in front of me. That's why I provided us with a drink you might remember from the last time we were in this room. As Dr. Barnes walks back to the other side of the table, I pick up the glass and study its contents. There's nothing to distinguish it from water, not the look or the smell. It appears innocuous. But it could be the same liquid as the one I was required to consume during my interview, and I know looks are deceiving. Even after taking a serum that was designed to counteract the effects of the interview drug, I still felt a sense of euphoria once I drank it, and the desire to tell those who questioned me everything they wanted to know. Thankfully, the serum allowed me to think before I answered and to control my responses. I don't have the benefit of that serum now. I'm not going to drink this. I set the glass down on the table. And I'm not going to insist that you do. The drink is for me, he says. I'm just offering you the opportunity in case you doubt my claim about what's in the glass. I'm confused. Is what he has to tell me so important that he would willingly consume the truth drug he once forced me to take? The one that, with Simon's help, I beat? How do I know you haven't taken the serum that negates it? I ask. You don't. Dr. Barnes leans back in his chair and nods. You are always one to trust your instincts. What do you think? I don't know what to think. This is another test, perhaps the last one I will ever